You're listening to Health Savvy You, where understanding health starts with you. I'm Dr. Navjot Butter, a dental surgeon, health communication epidemiologist, and your friend on the journey to better health literacy. In every episode, I break down complex health info, teach you how to spot fake health tips, and share practical tools to help you think clearly, ask smarter questions, and make confident health choices. Keep listening, because becoming healthier shouldn't feel out of reach. It should feel empowering. Welcome to another episode of Health Savvy You. Thank you for joining me today as we make progress through our second module, How Health Science Works. Please make sure to listen to the previous episodes if you haven't already, as we built upon them. In the last two episodes, we have discussed what research looks like. And today, we will discuss how health scientists use those research studies to decide what is good or bad for us. Since nothing comes without risks, how do scientists decide which risks are worth taking so that we all can be healthier? Let's start by unpacking what we actually mean when we say risk and benefit. In everyday life, we often think of risk as something bad that could happen and benefit as something good we hope will happen. Simple enough. But most of us picture them as absolutes. A medicine is either safe or dangerous. A food is either good or bad. In science, though, things are rarely that black and white. Scientists live in the land of probabilities and trade-offs. A risk is the chance that something harmful might happen, and benefit is the chance that something helpful might happen. In public health, that idea becomes more structured. We often define risk as the probability of harm multiplied by its severity, and benefit as the probability of improvement multiplied by its magnitude. A small risk of something serious may matter more than the large risk of something minor in public health. Likewise, even modest benefits can add up when they reach millions of people. So the difference between individual and population thinking really matters. Each of us naturally thinks at the individual or personal level, will this help me or hurt me? Public health, by contrast, looks at collective good. What helps the greatest number of people with least total harm? It's not that one way of looking at risks and benefits is right and the other is wrong. Both views simply answer different questions. And this gap between our search for certainty and science's language of likelihood is often where mistrust creeps in. When scientists say safe, they usually mean low risk, not no risk. Understanding that difference is the first step towards seeing how evidence-based decisions keep us safer even in an uncertain world. In everyday life, when someone asks, "Is it safe?" we often want a yes or no answer, but science can't usually give us that. Instead, scientists collect evidence through many different ways and then weigh that evidence to see whether the benefits are likely to outweigh the risks. Let me walk you through some of the ways how public health folks measure and weigh risks and benefits. Saying we measured the evidence sounds neat and tidy until you realize the evidence comes from dozens of different places, each speaking a slightly different language. Some tell us what works in ideal conditions, while others tell us what happens in messy, real life. If you caught episode 10, the science behind the science, how evidence really gets made, you already know these different types of studies, the randomized controlled trials, observation data, or studies done in the labs. That episode was our backstage pass to how those studies are done and why they are important. Today, we zoom out and ask, how do scientists take all the evidence from these studies and turn it into a decision of whether public health intervention is worth it or not? This is how scientists do it. They gather many lenses, not just one. Like, imagine looking at a mountain through binoculars. You can zoom in for detail or zoom out for the bigger picture. Scientists do both. They start with the sharp lens with studies like randomized controlled trials, the so-called gold standard. It's like a controlled test drive where we isolate variables and see if the new treatment or strategy actually works. But public health doesn't just live in a lab. So scientists also rely on observational studies or the real-world check-ins that show how something plays out when life is unpredictable and people aren't following a protocol. Scientists also do risk assessment or dose response detective work. How much exposure causes harm? Who is most vulnerable? The answers shape safety standards for everything from air pollution to medicine dosage. And public health doesn't just measure biological trade-offs. When we are done with the biology, we move to the economics. Cost-benefit analysis, cost-effectiveness studies. These don't mean we're putting a price tag on life. They are tools to help prioritize. If two programs both save life, but one saves 10 times more per dollar spent, that matters. All that evidence from those studies eventually gets translated into statistical language of risk. It's the way scientists put uncertainty into numbers so we can compare one thing with another. But those numbers are often misunderstood. For example, when you hear something doubles your risk, you might picture your odds shooting from small to scary. But what that really means depends on where you started. Imagine two neighborhoods. In one neighborhood, out of every 1,000 people, one person gets sick each year. In the other neighborhood, two people do. Now, scientists would say the risk is doubled. But if you think about it, one person versus two people out of 1,000, both numbers are still very small. The relative risk doubles, yes, but the absolute risk, the real-world likelihood for you to get sick, barely changed. That's why public health folks always ask about risk as compared to what or whom. When scientists talk about risk, they're just trying to be precise or take the number needed to treat, a concept that tells us how many people need to get the intervention to prevent one bad outcome. It reminds us that most people in any program may not personally feel an effect, but together, their participation makes the difference. These measures help scientists compare apples to apples, not to dismiss concerns, but to keep perspective grounded in proportion. Because in the end, these numbers are just ways to make uncertainty visible so that decisions aren't driven by fear or gut feeling, but by proportion, perspective, and care. Along with the mathematical evidence comes the layer of ethics and justice. Numbers can't make moral choices. That's where ethics enter, and we ask, who gets to decide what's an acceptable risk? Who bears that risk, and who benefits? If a vaccine helps millions but imposes a small burden, do we compensate those few? If a chemical regulation saves lives but costs more money, how do we balance health with economy? Public health ethics operate on four classic pillars. First is autonomy, that is, respecting people's ability to choose, especially for interventions that directly affect individuals. People should understand the risks and benefits and choose freely. Second is justice, that is, distributing the risks and benefits fairly, asking who bears the risk and who reaps the benefits. If a policy helps many but imposes burden on a vulnerable minority without compensation, there's a question of fairness. Public health must strive to avoid unequal distribution of harms. Third is beneficence, which means doing good or to intervene only if benefits justify the harms, and do so with humility and vigilance. And last is non-maleficence, which means doing no harm or as little as possible. And that's why when scientists debate a new guideline or intervention, they're not just crunching numbers, they're also negotiating values. And then scientists decide. It may make you uncomfortable, but health science is never 100% certain. But when action is needed, say during an outbreak, or environmental hazard, waiting for perfect data could cost many lives. That's where decision models come in. One of them is precautionary principle. It says that when there is credible risk of serious harm, don't wait for 100% proof, rather act to protect people. Of course, overusing this principle can backfire. Acting too soon on weak evidence can cause new harms or erode trust. It's a tightrope that public health scientists have to walk every day. There's also proportionate response, which is a reminder that our reaction should match the scale of the threat. A mild risk doesn't need a dramatic intervention, but a catastrophic one does. Then we also have harm reduction. This is the philosophy of real world. It accepts that perfect safety doesn't exist, but that smaller harms are better than larger ones. Needle exchange programs, seatbelt laws, even lower nicotine cigarette policies all come from this approach. These models are frameworks that say, let's act, but carefully. But public health doesn't stop after introducing an intervention to the world. We keep listening and revising. Once a decision is made, it's not locked forever. Science has a built-in feedback loop. Data keeps coming in. We watch, learn, adjust. When guidance changes, it's not a confession of failure, but a sign that system is constantly working and breathing. Decision-making is an iterative process. As evidence evolves, so do our actions. By using structured evidence, transparent models, and ethical reflection, public health scientists don't pretend to eliminate risk. Instead, we aim to steer risk, shrinking it where possible, distributing it fairly, and aligning interventions with values of justice and well-being. So now that we know how scientists measure and weigh risks and benefits, let's bring that to life with some common everyday examples. Because risk and benefit aren't abstract ideas, they're decisions we live with every single day. Let's see how that balance plays out in real world. I'm going to start with something close to the driver's seat. When seatbelt and airbag laws first came in, not everyone was happy. People said about seatbelts, they are uncomfortable, or it should be their choice. And they were right. Seatbelts were uncomfortable. The early belts left marks. Airbags even caused some injuries in the beginning. But here's where science entered conversation. Researchers didn't argue feelings. They brought evidence. They studied thousands of crashes before and after these safety features were introduced. They didn't look for perfection. They looked for probability. How much safer are we on average when we wear them? The data was crystal clear. Buckling up reduced the risk of dying in a crash by nearly half. Airbags saved tens of thousands more lives. Even after accounting for early design flaws, a broken shoulder became a small prize for saving millions of families from tragedy. That's population-level thinking, a small inconvenience for a monumental gain for all. Now let's take the example of something we have collectively experienced in near past, quarantine and lockdowns. The very words carry weight: isolation, stillness, empty streets, and closed businesses. For many of us, it was the hardest part of living through a pandemic. Here again, scientists faced an impossible trade-off. How do we stop a virus without stopping life itself? The tools they used were models, data, and observation. They tracked infections before and after restrictions. They compared places that locked down early with those that didn't. And they estimated how many lives were saved this way. The numbers showed that early short-term lockdowns slowed spread and bought hospitals time to breathe. But the costs were real too. Loneliness, job loss, mental health strain. Over time, the science evolved. We learned to move from blanket shutdowns to targeted measures, better ventilation, testing, masks, vaccines, and social support. This is where the precautionary principle met proportionate response. Act fast when danger looms, but adjust when you know more. It wasn't perfect like it never is, but it was the process of learning in real time, balancing competing harms for the collective good. Another example is the air we breathe. We can't see it, can't hold it, and yet it's one of the biggest determinants of our health. Air quality regulations are the masterclass in long-term risk-benefit thinking. For decades, researchers tracked communities before and after cleaner air policies took effect. They measured levels of tiny pollutants, such as PM2.5, nitrogen dioxide, and linked them to hospitalizations, asthma rates, and heart diseases. Over time, as the air got cleaner, people lived longer. Cities literally added years to their citizens' lives. Were there trade-offs? Of course. Industries spent billions upgrading systems, jobs shifted, and economic debates rose. But when researchers compared the numbers, that is, health benefits versus economic cost, the results were staggering. environmental scientists estimate that the benefits of cleaner air outweigh costs by more than 30 to 1. Fewer heart attacks, fewer strokes, fewer parents rushing kids to ER with wheezing lungs. That's how science measures work, not in ideology and feelings, but in real human outcomes. What ties these stories together? Each began with uncertainty, debate, and discomfort. Each used evidence, epidemiology, risk assessment, cost-benefit analysis to guide decisions, and in every case, safe never meant risk-free. It meant worth it, because that's really what risk-benefit thinking asks of us, not perfection, but perspective. When we think collectively, not just what does this mean for me, but what does this mean for us, we start to see the beauty of prevention. It's invisible when it works, but it's the quiet force that keeps societies healthy, alive, and moving forward. So after hearing about all those real-world examples, seatbelts, lockdowns, cleaner air, I know you still have the question, but are these things really safe? Here's the honest answer. Safety doesn't mean zero risk. It means the risks are known, monitored, and outweighed by the benefits. That's a shift in understanding we need. When scientists say something is safe, they mean we have measured the odds, we're watching them constantly, and the benefits of our collective well-being far exceed small potential for harm. Think about it like flying. No plane is ever risk-free, but aviation is one of the safest ways to travel. Not because accidents never happen, but because every single one is investigated, learned from, and used to make the next flight safer. Public health works exactly like that. Behind every guideline, every food standard, water regulation, or medicine approval, there's an ongoing system of accountability. Data keeps flowing in long after the first decision is made. Epidemiologists monitor real-world effects. Regulators check for side effects, unintended outcomes, environmental impact. Communities are invited to share their lived experiences, because numbers alone don't tell the whole story. And when guidance changes, as it sometimes does, that's not proof that science got it wrong. It's proof that science learns. Every new data set, every health outcome, every unexpected finding adds to the body of knowledge. The safest systems are not the ones that never change, but the ones that keep changing in response to evidence. So when we say public health interventions are safe, we're saying they exist inside a living ecosystem, one that watches, corrects, and adapts. It's a kind of safety that grows stronger over time. But safety is only half the story. The real heart of public health, the part that often gets lost in technical reports, is empowerment. Public health doesn't just protect us, it gives us power. Seatbelts didn't take away freedom. They gave us mobility without fear. Clean air didn't slow industry. It gave us stronger lungs to lead longer, healthier lives. Fortified foods didn't just prevent diseases, they gave millions of children a fairer start in life by protecting their brains and bones before they ever saw a doctor. That's what empowerment looks like. It's not the loud kind that makes headlines. It's quiet, persistent, invisible when it works, but it touches every one of us. When we understand risk, we can stop being afraid of it. We can ask smarter questions, make informed choices, and hold systems accountable without tearing them down completely. Listening to public health isn't about obedience. It's about co-owning the system that keeps us alive. And that's crucial, because when misinformation spreads, when we rush to reject an intervention because it feels unfamiliar or uncomfortable, it's often the most helpless who pay the price. When water fluoridation stops, it's low-income kids who lose protection from cavities. When vaccine coverage dips, it's newborns, elders, immunocompromised who fall ill first. When air regulation loosens, it's people in crowded neighborhoods who breathe the dirtiest air. Every time we weaken prevention, inequality grows. So empowerment isn't just about having knowledge, but rather it is about using it to protect one another. We all share in this invisible safety net. Scientists, health workers, policymakers, and every one of us who chooses to act not only for ourselves, but for our communities. Public health is a collective act of love, a promise that we will look out for each other even when we can't see the danger. So next time we hear about a new policy, a health advisory, or a change in recommendation, maybe we pause and ask, what risks are being managed here? And whose safety is being strengthened? Because every public health decision is, at its core, an act of weighing not just numbers, but also values. And when we understand that, we become a part of the process, not just the audience to it. Thank you so much for becoming a part of today's conversation. For one more time, choosing curiosity over fear and trust over noise. I will see you again in 2 weeks with another episode in our How Health Science Works series. If you think someone can benefit from this episode and series, please share it with them to follow and subscribe. Until we meet again, stay savvy, stay healthy.
Thank you for tuning into Health Savvy You. I hope today's episode brought you one step closer to feeling confident, curious, and in control of your health. If you found this episode helpful, share it with someone you care about. Keep learning and remember, health literacy is for everyone, including you. Be sure to follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode. I have got more great conversations coming your way. See you next time, and until then, stay savvy, stay healthy.